Good evening. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, which is a weekly lecture series that runs until April 21st this season, and then it'll begin up again for the next season. Next week, though, we get to preview the upcoming Focus exhibition, Focus Mario Garcia Torres, as the artist Mario Garcia Torres, his collaborator, who is a musician and songwriter, J.D. Wittenberg, and the exhibition curator, the Modern's own Allison Hurst, are in conversation about Mario's project here and then other projects that Mario has done, including, I don't know actually if they will talk about, but when I was first introduced to Mario's work was at the Venice Biennale, and he's a very interesting artist who focuses on conceptual art from the 60s and 70s, and then being a young artist brings it into his moment. Tonight we are honored to welcome one of the most influential and innovative photographers working today, Philip Lorca de Corsia. Well known for images that blur the distinctions between documentary and stage tableau, Philip Lorca is here in conjunction with the museum's recent acquisition of one such photograph from his celebrated Hustler series. The title of the photograph is Tim Morgan Jr., 21 years old, Los Angeles, California, $25, / Joe Ugra. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing Joe's name correctly. 18 years old, Los Angeles, California, $25. Which can currently be seen on the second floor of the Modern Collection exhibition, Framing Desire, Photography and Video. And I hope some of you, if not all of you, have seen that image. Philip Lorca de Corsia was born in Hartford, Connecticut, attended the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, received an MFA from Yale University, and now lives and works in New York while serving as a senior critic at Yale. As an innovative photographer, Philip Lorca has developed an impressive and varied career, conceiving, composing, and shooting incredible photographs for the fashion industry and high-end publications that have brought him great acclaim, as they are comparable to their content, lighting, and cinematic presentation to his stunning and provocative fine art photography from the various series he is so readily known for, such as Hustlers, Heads, and East of Eden. Represented since 2007 by David Zwirner Gallery in London and New York, Philip Lorca has shown extensively across the globe, including a 2013 major career-spanning survey consisting of over 100 works from 16 series, which was organized by the Schön Kunsthal Frankfurt, traveling to the DuPont in the Netherlands and the Hepworth Wakefield in England in 2014. Other major solo exhibitions include museum exhibitions include an exhibition at LA County Museum of Art in 2008 and the Institute of Contemporary Art, Boston, in 2007, with his first museum solo exhibition being organized by no other than the MoMA in New York in 1993. And we are fortunate that he agreed to be here tonight, given the fact that he has a solo exhibition titled East of Eden, opening this Thursday, as in day after tomorrow, at David Zwirner in New York, where it runs through May 2nd. So I hope some of you will make it to New York and catch that exhibition. Philip Lorca's work can be found in almost any major international public collection, such as the Centre Georges Pompidou in Paris, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, MoMA, and Guggenheim and the Whitney in New York, SF MoMA, LA County, and the MoCA in LA, the Reina Sofia in Madrid, Tate Gallery and the V&A in London, and of course the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, which is, in part at least, what brought us here tonight. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Philip Lorca de Corsia.
Does that sound good? Well, I don't really know how many of you are art students or how many of you are photography aficionados or how many of you have nothing else to do tonight, but it's kind of a weird trajectory that I've passed through all of that, and I don't really expect in less than an hour to elucidate you and, you know, on your path, but I can sort of explain a little bit about my own, and maybe you can learn a bit from that, though it's always speculative. We were talking about Mario something, and it's because I don't know him personally. I don't mean to insult his name because I don't remember it completely, but that's my brother, and his name is Mario. And I did that when I was a student, and I'm not sure exactly how I arrived at that, except at a sort of revulsion, you know, from the contemporary practice of photography. 1977 or 8 or 9, I graduated from Yale in 1979. You'd be surprised how easy it was to graduate from Yale in 1979. Maybe it's even easier now. All you have to do is get in. It's sort of like being a basketball player in Kentucky. That was my brother, and that was my father's house. And a lot of people say a lot of things about this photograph, like he's contemplating his life and everything. But in fact, he was probably just contemplating his stomach. The point is that in the practice of art and photography, you have to transform these things in your own way, which is, you know, to some percent instinct and to some percent genetics. This is, well, that picture was 1979. This is like 1990. And the project that I was doing is kind of well described. If you really want to find out about it, you can probably read about it pretty easily. But they were all male prostitutes, and the usual questions, so don't ask me them later, are like, why male and not female, what, you know, whatever. But it was the height of the AIDS epidemic, and my brother had died the year before of AIDS, and it was not, I think, particularly prescient of me to try to make a project of it, besides the fact that I got money from the government to do it. And the government at that time had denied AIDS as a real thing, actually. It was almost like a criminal act. I paid these people. Well, this is not them, but this is always called Maryland because that was the assumed identity of this person. And I would pay them and tell them what I was doing, and you know, I had no outlet for this. In fact, I didn't even have a gallery when this project was done, though I had gotten in succession a Guggenheim Fellowship and a NEA grant to individual artists, which don't exist anymore. So if anyone you know ever wonders where your taxpayers' money is going, that's where it went. I think I'm going through this in a very organized way. What I decided to do next, which was more or less to take photographs of people without having them cooperate, because I had arranged photographs for years in this sort of tableau style that I guess I'm more known for, but I just wanted things to happen that I didn't control. And so these pictures have absolutely nothing to do. I never talked to the people. I had nothing to do with them. There are artificial lights. I mean, that's not a real situation. That's in Times Square in New York. And the light is attached to scaffolding. It was during the Giuliani administration in which they changed, you know, basically the whole ethos of New York, which I'm not sure if I preferred crack to cash, but nonetheless, I responded to it. And this guy, as a lot of people know, sued me. He's one of the only people who has ever done that. I don't know why, my speculation would only get me in trouble. This is a photograph I did, what I considered to be a project, which was called A Storybook Life, which was meant to be one thing, in which I tried to reduce the idea of the perfect photograph as, you know, the monograph in a book where every one of the images is sort of meant to express your best work. I didn't think of it that way. I thought of it as some way to sort of put everything together in a way that had a narrative and suggested the, an interaction between the images, but not like, for instance, if you're photography majors, Robert Frank's connection between a car covered in a shroud and a man dead on the street, you know, with a shroud in the next photograph. You have to wait. And waiting is, I think, maybe it has something to do with my interest in film, but that's my father. It was the last year of his life, and actually, I think it was the last year I was a student at Yale. And I bring up Yale a lot, like I'm proud of it or something, but I'm from Connecticut. You know, it's not like I couldn't go somewhere else. I mean, or do something else. It was just obvious. And he was an architect, which is why I love this museum. It's like, you know, it's a piece of work, and the Kimball is a piece of work. I think my father graduated about the same time that Louis Kahn was still there. So it was great to come here and see all of this. You can figure out the connection. That's my son. So obviously dead, or almost dead, just born. A lot of people think that he looks like a doll. Well, he's 22 now. He's like almost 6'7". A lot of girls think he's a doll. You know, I've always used people who I know. This guy was, he worked in a bookstore and smoked a lot. So, you know, I don't know if working in the bookstore comes across in the photograph, but he's definitely smoking. You know, the idea that you're on the outside looking in is very deliberate. And some people call that cinematic or whatever. It's more or less an attempt to remove myself from this. A lot of people remember or have read that, you know, I went to school in Boston with Nan Golden and David Armstrong and Mark Morrisroe and all of these people who have, you know, established reputations that most photography students are aware of. Well, I was really absolutely totally against having it be about me. And, of course, all of the people I just mentioned are all about them. And I've kind of continued to try to follow that trajectory. This is the last page of the book, A Storybook Life, which, as I said, was never meant to be a collection of, like, you know, greatest hits. It was meant to be a loose assemblage of things that make you think about what you see later, not right now. And that was always my intention in photography. Because it's when I first started out, photography was all about photojournalism and the moment and this idea of the time that you sort of magically encapsulate something. And I sort of went about it the other way around. I try to imaginatively and magically, maybe even, that's to be determined, encapsulate these things, but not now. I mean, you have to look at it for a while. So, you know, it sort of creeps up on you. This sort of stealth I don't know. I'm not even going to call it meaning because I don't know what it means. But stealth was part of it. Actually, this guy's not a hustler, but it was done during that period in which I would go out and I would prearrange. Like, I rented that motel room. I had an assistant. I would set up some lights. I would sort of try to figure out exactly what I wanted to do, and then I would get in a car and I would go to where hustlers were, and I would say, listen, I don't want sex, I'll pay you, and you'd be, you know, it was strange because when this was first exhibited at MoMA, like, they put, like, part of the title is how much it paid them. And they thought that's how much the picture cost. And it was like $35 or something like that. I mean, I was just like, what are you, crazy? I mean, I couldn't develop the film for that. This guy I really liked, but he was just a nutcase living on the street. He was not a hustler. But the light that's facing him, that comes from me. It's outside the door. It's, I use remotely triggered flashes. To some degree, I learned that from working commercially, just how to put the pieces together, although Anyone who does that now is far more sophisticated than me because I'm not a digital person. But basically ask these people to do these things. I mean, I wasn't there while this guy is standing on a chair. I mean, I was there, but it wasn't like I just captured some moment out of my own life. And people get a little bit weirded out by the fact that, all right, I don't, you know, I'm not gay. I don't, you know, what, my brother was gay. He died of AIDS. So, yeah, there's some relationship to it. But half of these guys are gay for pay. And, you know, it was to some degree a reflection of what happens when you've got nowhere to go and you wind up in Hollywood of all places. And why wasn't it a woman? There's a lot of prostitutes in Hollywood. Well, because they don't pretend. They're always the same, you know, Julia Roberts part. And, the men were always, despite the fact that my brother had died, they do the village people thing. They're faking their identity, and they're in Hollywood. So that seemed very interesting to me. Of course, LA has its, you know, its beautiful light and things you can exploit. But could I have gotten that woman to reach over? I don't even know if you think that's an essential element of the image, but no. It just happened. But he was standing there, the light that's on him coming from what is, I guess, your right side is mine. Strangely enough, this guy was the former lover of an actor who was from Hartford, Connecticut. It's really kind of strange. He was in weird movies like The Robe or, you know, Disney movies. But he died of AIDS, too. I can't testify for the, you know, quality of the reproductions. But, there is obviously a relationship between commodity and the person. I don't expect anybody to buy this stuff and stick it on their wall and feel happy, though people kind of do. I don't know how happy they feel, but it does happen. How conscious was I that you equate this person and a commodity, which I was certainly aware of. But I didn't necessarily put that Pepsi container there. I just thought, like, that's a very big container. And I had to put a light on it. The blue that comes under his chin is a reflection of his, let me just put it this way. None of these photographs in real life actually look anything like what it was like if you were standing next to me. So if there's artifice involved or, you know, anything else, I take responsibility for it, good or bad. There is, if you're a photographer, quite a large manipulation of the different elements that are involved, being the shutter speed, the flash, the degree to which you have to make somebody stand still for a long time. All of these are used to be very common elements in photography. Now you get a digital camera and they can take a picture, you know, basically in, you know, you can turn off the lights in your bathroom and do a self-portrait. This guy, well, there's a red screen. This was my assistant's apartment. That guy is what they call a fluffer. He's the only one I photographed almost 90 people, but I never really talked to them. I never went home with them. This was really hyper-criticized at that time because in the world of photojournalism, the idea that you're not actually portraying the circumstances of these people's lives in a way that illuminates their injustice, their justice, their whatever, was like, I just faked it. So people really didn't like it, but I almost never went home to their houses. I never went home to their houses. I would pick them up on the street and then deliver them back or wherever they wanted to go, which was usually somewhere to buy crack. This guy, somebody came up to me and told me later he was dead. But I'm sure a lot of them were. This is a sort of second version of the photograph that was in the MoMA show. MoMA gave me the show in 1993 of this work. It was a weird time at the Museum of Modern Art, not that most of you care, but it was the handoff of the direction of the Department of Photography from John Sarkowski, who was a huge influence in the development of photography as art and in museums, to Peter Galassi. And they told me I couldn't really show the work for a year and a half because museums have a big backup time. You know, it's like they're not going to give you a show next week. So this is a second version. I don't know exactly why, but they have the same the book that MoMA published has Bill Cosby in it. But of course there was no remote controls in a cheap motel. I mean, I had to go over and hit the thing. The other version has Bill Cosby almost talking to him. This one was a coincidence. I don't know who the actor on the TV is. It could be the guy that, is in Star Wars. But the fact that they both have their eyes closed was sort of enough to me. And I did not dress that guy up or undress that guy up. That's the way he stood on the street with the blue on his face. And he's one of the only people I ever photographed twice in this whole thing. And the next year he was destroyed. I don't have a photograph, but his teeth had fallen out. I mean, it was just a mess. And that happened a few times, because I went back like five or six times. Once for an entire month, although I didn't do much photography during that time. So I finished that. And, you know, I had some momentum at that point, as you can imagine. I had to show at MoMA and stuff like that. And there was, at that time, kind of antagonism toward MoMA because photography didn't have a market like it has in the last 10 years and stuff like that. Nobody really cared about it. But they seemed to think that there was something, you know, monumental about MoMA. So, you know, I didn't even have a gallery through almost all of this. So I started this project, which I, you know, called Street Work, in which I set up lights on the street and put my camera there. This was in Times Square, which looks nothing like that anymore. And I didn't arrange anything. I mean, I went from trying to control everything to trying to let happenstance, serendipity, whatever you want to call it, be the guiding rule. And in a way, I've returned to that. But this was one of the first of them. And I just got lucky. I mean, the street preacher, the guy, I don't even know what the guy is trying to do, but he's walking, you know. Is he really blind? I have no idea. So I continued with this same routine, you could call it, in different places. This is Japan. That was what 42nd Street looked like at that time. And well, I sort of finished that project, and then I just decided to change it because they started to change 42nd Street. So it was Giuliani. I am not a Republican. I know I'm in a Republican state here, but you know, he was just like awful to me. And what was going on with the Disneyfication of Times Square. So I started in Times Square to photograph these people under the awnings of the buildings that were being put up. So what you see there is actually in the middle of Times Square, but because they put up scaffolding, it's blacked out from, it's just like in the middle of the day. It's like 11 o'clock or something like that. So I put my lights, in this case there's two, which are remotely controlled. And then it might have been infrared, but now they're radio syncs. It's a pretty normal thing now. And I stood very far away with the longest lens that I could get, which is basically for bird watchers and sports photographers. And I photographed these people. Like, there's no actual way to decide what to do in that situation because it's such a long lens that they walk out of the image area in a fraction of a second. So I had to know exactly where the camera was focused, exactly where the light was. If they were too tall, their head was chopped off. If they were too small, they're, you know, whatever. You can figure it out. My assistant was a young Korean woman, and she was way too small. And I had to, like, adjust the camera height to what I considered to be a kind of normal thing. And I put a piece of tape on the ground where the camera was focused and where the lights were focused as well. And when somebody hit that thing, I would just take their picture. And I sometimes understood, like, that was a good one. but most of the time I had no idea. And that was an early one. Yeah, there's all types of people. And yeah, that guy had no idea that his photograph was being taken. He saw in a New York Times review of the show that his photograph was in a gallery. He just got in touch with me, and he was very nice about it, and I gave him a copy of the picture and didn't bother me. The Hasidic guy, on the other hand, sued me. I don't know if I'm making a comparison here. I don't really mean to. This is my favorite picture of all of them because I don't think I've ever seen anybody so innocent looking. But, you know, there's very little digital manipulation in any of these photographs. The only digital manipulation in this is that the woman behind her was looking right at me. And I try to not have anyone look at the camera because it acknowledges the presence of the photographer, which is part of what people call the cinematic look. But, you know, that's the truth. I mean, in a movie, you're not supposed to notice that there's a camera. So that's why I get that whatever. In the meantime, I have always worked as a magazine photographer, if you want to call it that. So I had a long relationship with W Magazine, and this was one of the images that we did. It was, you know, everybody is cast, everybody is, you know, they're sort of all models, but strangely enough, the guy in the middle was a hustler from Florida. And, you know, sort of the whole idea is like he's playing the two of them off each other. And you can date it by the fact that, you know, that's the World Trade Center. So that's the observation deck behind them, and they're in the restaurant that was on top of part of it. I was really there and have a hard time, you know, because my son was like caught in a lot of stuff. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't damaged, although they still monitor his lungs, which don't seem to be very good. But this was that story. It's just one story. I did 11 stories for W, and it was basically about a boy toy. You could get away with this stuff in those days. I did other things. This one was in Cuba. You know, these are all fashion photographs done for a fashion magazine. Same, you know, it's the same woman. Just, you know. And by the way, it's, I don't know how I can point this out, but, you know, this is when I converted to digital, although I don't shoot digitally, because everything is retouched in fashion. I mean, there's somebody in between. And if you really look, the same guy appears a couple of times, you know, outside. She's always the same. But you could change things. So I thought, like, well, might as well embrace it. Everybody else is. This is another one, though there's nothing really altered about this photograph other than the fact that I used to have to figure out how to hide the flashes that I use, and then someone said to me, why do you have to hide them? You just take them out and post. So this is where I learned that, you know, the guy on the edge there, there's a flash like suction cupped to that glass. And I was like, how am I going to get this out? You know, and they were just like, just take it out later. These are other, you know, are they fantasies or not? This is in Buenos Aires. It's a long, you know, it's a long story. I mean, you know, it's just, but they bring this stuff. And it's like, why did you bring a wedding dress? And I was like, well, okay. And then, of course, I found a way to use it because wedding dresses have this huge train. And I never saw a ceiling like that before. There is actually a flash stuck up there on her. But, you know, dealing with little kids is not easy. This one was done in Cairo, and very strangely, there was a store. We were doing something else, and the store was called Born. This is totally a reflection. The only thing that's actually captured, you know, a real capture is on the right-hand side, that guy going by. But, you know, guys there, they're very aggressive toward women. And, you know, women have to wear the headscarf and all of this. Even that was 2008. I don't know, what's the lesson? Born. I mean, you know, I was given the, you know, I didn't choose that place. I just noticed it. But if you're not capable of if you were to try to break this down in class, I mean, it's all fragmented. So figure it out. this was another. This was about these people, the promise keepers. There was like a big movement at one point. They're all praying over the pizza. That was in Minneapolis. My assistant, who at that time was Jewish, almost threw up. And went out, it was like 20 below zero, and sat in the car and smoked cigarettes for a half an hour while I worked, because he was just so appalled by it all. But I didn't get into that. These were my response to 9/11, which at that time I couldn't really talk about, but it was sort of like I had a fascination with the idea that, you know, I mean, well, this one photograph that was in the New York Times, like the day after, of this guy falling from the towers, and you can see the sort of vertical lines of the tower and his body, and it was upturned. So I kept that thing on my sort of tape to a light or something like that, and I looked at it a lot. And then I put together this idea that, like, well, I don't know how people respond to these things, but all right, Eros and Thanatos are like almost brothers in mythology, and they're sex and death. And it seemed to me that the United States had made an obsession, almost a sexual obsession, about what had happened. Most people had never been there. They had no, I mean, I was there. You know, I didn't lose any, well, I did, just one friend, but it was coincidental. And I just thought, like, you know, I'm going to try to put these things together. And I don't know how I figured out that, like, a pole dancer who is inverted, like they're falling, is in some way a representative of what I thought was a pretty perverted, and whatever anybody in this room might think about what happened, I can't say personally that it didn't turn out to be a total disaster for the United States. And a few years later, when the atmosphere had calmed down and you could actually say something without everybody accusing you of being a traitor or something, I did this series. So yes, they're pole dancers and they're all inverted, like they're falling. That was in Las Vegas. The other one was in New York. I think this is in Las Vegas. Not totally. All right, you got the point. In the meantime, I did a series of a book called 1,000, which is 1,000 Polaroids. And the point is not that you can make sense of 1,000 Polaroids, but that you can make sense of the way that you understand things when you see them. And you don't even have to see them in sequence, which was an offshoot of a Storybook Life, that other book. And so that's the way it was presented, which is, they're all on a little rail. So they're all Polaroids, more or less the same size. They're backed by aluminum, so they're just resting there. And that's just one room. Out of 1,000, I would say that's not even 700. They went in a sort of circular shape in the gallery that represents me in New York. There's a book, it's called 1,000. I think it's out of print at this point, but anyway. That was sort of the next project. These are examples of some of them. The numbers that you see have to do with references so that we could organize it for the book. None of these pictures were made for the book, not one. I mean, there were a few, actually, because I came up a bit short of 1,000 and started to try to actively make things. There's a few different things here, like the one on the lower right. That is me, but there used to be a camera where you could make two Polaroids on one piece of the Polaroid back. The choice of imagery here is pretty random. The choice of sequence was not at all random. I mean, it took me a very long time to put them in order. But there is an order. And, you know, for me, since we're talking about me, or I'm talking about me, the idea is that at a certain point you have to allow yourself a license. Like, I had done it according to the rules for a long time. I worked in commerce. I worked in a lot of different things. And, photography was an avocation and a job. And these things never went into the job category. But at the same time, I wouldn't have done them if I didn't do the job. So, I don't know. It was just, these are sort of the images that came out. They're all very small Polaroids, as you saw from that previous picture. And you can see that they're, you know, from Egypt to whatever. They're personal, they're not personal. That led to this project, which is what is actually going to be exhibited in New York starting day after tomorrow, which was called East of Eden, or is called East of Eden. I can talk about that, but I don't really want to bore you all to death. I just want to point out a few things. So you have the imagery upstairs. You have the Richard Prince, who is everybody's idea of the Marlboro Man and all that kind of stuff, except for the fact that most of those pictures came, if you look at the dates, quite a bit later than the original, like, appropriated image. He just kept producing them in order to make money, if you ask me, and a lot of money. And it always pissed me off when people said, "Oh, it looks like a Richard Prince picture." But in fact, it's in a place in California. I can't tell you the backstory, but that place had just gone through a forest fire. The whole idea of the East of Eden project was the loss of innocence, the casting out from Eden, the biblical sense that human beings had lost their way for many different reasons. So it looks kind of Edenic in a way, but in fact it's all burnt out. The only part that's green is right in the middle because the stream flows right to it, so it didn't burn up. I didn't hire that guy, but I did tell him to do that. And I guess it's like what I'm doing now. It started out when I thought, like, loss of innocence. Well, okay, somebody told me that blind people don't dream. Which is actually true if you're born blind, but not actually true if you go blind, because they just don't have any memory, image bank to dream with. So these are both blind people. I never have people look at the camera. I mean, I avoid that completely because it acknowledges the fact that I'm there. But I thought it was okay that he was kind of looking at the camera because he can't see. So it was all kind of along that train of thought. I also like the fact that the dog looks sort of like her. They were a couple, actually, broken up, but they're both blind. This looks like one of the pole dancer pictures, but it's meant to be Lilith, the snake, that winds around the tree, and depending on different interpretations of the book of Genesis, it's a snake or a woman or whatever. And Lilith is, well, I don't know, anyway, I never really met anyone who could do that, except this one woman. And I went out and sought her out in L.A. Because, believe me, that is not easy. I mean, she's basically walking on the ceiling with nothing holding her up. And strangely enough, she was pregnant. Another one from that same area that was burnt out. by fire. She wore a dress that had flowers on it. I don't know if you can see that. That is slightly manipulated, but it's the San Joaquin Valley, and the two cars I did not put in there. It's not, I didn't add that to them, but I thought of it as sort of like Adam and Eve, you know, modern day Adam and Eve leaving the Garden of Eden. The San Joaquin Valley is actually never meant to be what it is. You can see in the background the Colorado River, which is used as the source of agriculture for the entire thing, which is basically arid. And they're being sort of expelled in some way. Is that luck? Yeah, I guess it's luck, because I did not put those cars there. But they're identical cars. Another part. This is a town called Mount Ararat, which is the, you know, the Book of Genesis, where the ark wound up on the top of. So I don't know. I mean, it's very American style picture. But it also has those windmills in the back. This is also part of it. This was done, is there any relief from the contrast between the red and the blue in our political system? But these are two gay guys. They're a couple. And, one has a red-blue shirt on, one has a blue shirt on, clearly. I have to tell you that. That is a model who was really pregnant, and I had her belly button sort of removed because Eve would have had no belly button because she never gave birth. There's not a lot, really manipulated about these pictures. Yeah, things that get cleaned up compared to what people do. It's not that much. This is one of the last images, even though it wasn't done in sequence. And that's my ex, I guess, but she's still, I consider, my mother-in-law. She's 90 years old, and I couldn't have made that ship pass. That's from a hotel in New York Harbor, if I wanted to. I mean, I just happened to be, in the right place at the right time. And by the way, that doesn't really exist. I have a flash suction cupped to that giant pane of glass because you would never see her reflection unless there was something like blasting her face to make it, reflect. So, and the tornado was not on the TV. I mean, we stayed there after it was all over and just went to the Weather Channel. And you leave the camera on the tripod, you don't move it, and it's quite easy to change, these elements because it's really not like advanced Photoshop. It's just switching out one element for another because they're all, the frame is exactly the same. I don't know how that got in there. I think we're going around again. Okay. All right, I'll just go as fast as I can until I know we're completely through with that. These are just the Hustler pictures that were done. this guy, I mean, oh my God, what he suffered. But yeah, that's the one that we should probably end on. This is the one that's upstairs. Anybody got any questions?
Did you and your brother ever have a conversation about your interest in hustlers?
My brother was dead by that point.
No.
No.
Can you talk a little bit about the access point between inside and outside of your pictures?
Do you mean literally? I mean, because we're looking at a photograph in which there's an inside and an outside. I don't know. It's sort of like going around the, like, let's say the Kimball, because they're the ones where I, because you don't have explanatory. What do they call them? You know, text by the wall. So you read it, and they're just like, well, used, you know, Masaccio's, you know, discoveries of perspective and this and that and the other thing. And I find it really weird that people don't actually think that there is any relationship between early Renaissance thinking or anything else and photography, because everybody has this point of view, which is that it's at the eye of the beholder. So I never have the camera at the eye of the beholder. It's never to my face. And so that makes me, in some way, a sort of manipulator of perspective. And if you notice it, there, it's all straight right angle to the camera. I mean, the picture plane is flush. And, you know, that's quite deliberate, but it's deliberate for a way that is, for instance, when I first started doing it, it was because I wanted there to be a sense that, all right, somebody is controlling this thing, but I don't know what it is. Why? I don't even realize it, because I'm so used to photographs which are caught on the sly and askance and all of this kind of stuff. And like, here's this guy that comes and everything is square, everything is right angles and all of that kind of stuff. And why is that? But they don't even actually ask that question, because it's not a question that anybody really cares about. But they know the question subconsciously, and that was what I was trying to do. Yes?
This is kind of a complicated question.
Uh-oh.
But I'm struck by the title of your most recent work, and I'm wondering that it has anything to do with Todd Papageorge's passing through the photographs of Central Park and the name of that book, and the way that it has those kind of ties. And then the second part of my question is the kind of mentor relationship between you and Todd, and how that might relate to Walker Evans and Robert Franks, the Americans and American photographs.
Well, I don't know if 3/4 of this room understand half of what you just asked me. Yeah, I understand the question completely. Todd was my teacher, and I went to Yale, and I was there like just after Walker Evans had died, and Todd was chosen to be his replacement. And now Todd is gone. And to some degree, I'm gone. But I can't say that I didn't absorb some aspect of that, but I also have to say that a lot of this work was done, you know, Todd's Central Park pictures were just published like, whatever, 4 years ago or something like that? Well, I mean, it's not like he brought them into class. And I never got along with the guy anyway. I love him dearly right now, but, you know, this is after 30-some-odd years. And I guess one of the best things that can happen in an educational experience is antagonism. You know, somebody who just feeds you what you want to know is underserving you. And he never underserved me.
Can you talk a little bit about the way you approach your subject? Because I'm struck by the fact that it does have this cinematic quality that you mentioned before, and there is this temptation to create the narrative. And are you setting us up for a particular narrative? Do you know that going into it? Are you looking at it visually? And that...
You know, that's a hard question because now, you know, I've tried to make little films, like, you know, for very specific purposes. And I've also worked in situations like not just my own personal work, but for magazines or for whatever, for clients. And you get this, you know, you have to do it. In the case of a still, you just sort of, I can figure this out on the spot. If you're making a real film, you can't do that because everything is susceptible to change and variation, but there is no way that you can get that degree of production and all these people behind you without very specifically stating what you intend to do, even if you don't do it. So this idea that like I do cinematic work is actually kind of false. It's just the way it's lit, or the viewpoint, or there's a number of tricks, I suppose, if you want to call them tricks. But to actually make a film, it requires a much more elaborate sense of what you need to accomplish. Because you have to translate that to all the people who work for you. I don't mind never holding a camera again. I mean, you can tell somebody to do that. Where it becomes difficult is when I have no control over the final product. So being a still photographer, I can just say, all right, this is it. You know, this is what you get. The other end of it, being, you know, working in motion, is like, well, we don't like the way that comes out. I mean, you know, I was always enormously irritated by people who said, I didn't like that movie, the ending was bad. Like, well, that has nothing to do with it. And what was the question?
Are you setting up the narrative, or is it just a matter of us having this innate need to create the story, and you've given us enough information to do it? Or
I'm supposed to give you as little information in my mind as you need to be intrigued, not enough to finish, you know, your experience.
Is that more conducive to still photography than moving?
I don't really know, but I can tell you that part of it has to do with just a, you know, the entry-level art photography, you know, was, in my experience, you know, very explicit. And I want it to be implicit. And that's very hard to do in a medium that is as literal as photography. And, you know, that was my ambition.
I think that resistance is what makes your work so strong.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
I think you delivered.
All right.
Is that ready?